Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Take Latino USA and more with you wherever you go with the NPR One app. The suggestions in NPR One are hand-curated to help you find the best from public radio and beyond. News, local stories, and your favorite podcasts. NPR One is ready to make taking a trip, waiting in line, or waiting for a friend a whole lot better. Find NPR One on your app store now.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we're rebroadcasting part two of our Latino hip-hop history series. Last week, we aired part one and learned about hip-hop's origins in the Bronx. This week, we talk about what happened after the 1980s. Our episode is guest hosted by Daisy Rosario. So take it away, Daisy, and enjoy the show.
Know your history. If you love something so much, know your history. And if you want to shoot somebody, shoot them with the camera.
This is Joe Conzo Jr.
I'm Puerto Rican, first hip-hop photographer.
The New York Times once called him the man who took hip-hop's baby pictures. And he doesn't just laugh a lot. He can also be serious.
I go toe-to-toe with anybody that says that Latinos weren't there in the beginning.
Joe knows because he was there, in the Bronx, taking photos, documenting a culture as it was born.
I have a report card from 1972, which makes me 9, 10 years old. Joe's excelling in photography, and that's how young I started.
School also helped him find his subjects.
I went to school with some of the pioneers of the culture of hip-hop, the Cold Crush Brothers, Charlie Chase, Tony Tone, and the rest of them.
Which brought other opportunities.
Through them, I got to photograph Kool Herc, the Treacherous Three, the Fearless Four, you know, all the bricklayers of this foundation.
But like the kids around him in New York City in the 1970s who were creating hip-hop, Joe wasn't thinking of a career. He was just following his passion. He wasn't even selling his pictures. Oh, and we're talking about hip-hop, so there's a little bit of foul language. We bleeped it, but just a heads up. It wasn't until well after he had put the camera down that Joe even realized what he had actually accomplished.
So one day I'm sitting in a movie theater and I'm watching the movie CB4 with Chris Rock.
All my life I wanted to be a rapper.
And in the beginning of the film, there goes a Joe Conzo photograph. And I'm like, that's my image.
No credit, no compensation. So he revisited his work.
So I started getting my archives together.
One of Joe's pictures of DJ Charlie Chase got licensed to use in a movie. And things took off.
I started getting phone calls from VH1, MTV, and all that.
He's also been recognized by heavyweights within hip-hop.
Chuck D's a phenomenal person. And when I first met him, it was like, you're Joe Conzo? Some of your photographs, you don't understand.
He says respect comes from the way he treats his subjects. And that comes, in part, from being the real deal.
I'm one of, if not the only photographer that came from within the culture.
Joe says he wasn't one of the people sent by the downtown press to gawk at what the ethnic kids were doing uptown.
It's our history, and if we can't tell our own history, then who is? Somebody else is going to tell our own history? And that's something that's been instilled in me since the 60s and 70s, hearing Yoruba from the young lords.
And luckily for all of us, Joe's work is being preserved.
My archives, which sits at the Cornell University Hip Hop Collection and sits on the same shelf as the Gettysburg Address, how cool is that? Began in like 76, 77 and ended around 84, 85.
Which is right about where we left off in A Latino History of Hip Hop, Part 1. We talked about the very start of hip-hop, young people creating something amazing out of pretty much nothing on the streets of New York City. Just taking what they had around them and turning it first into expression and eventually an entire culture. We broke hip-hop down into what are often called the four elements, DJing, breakdancing or b-boying, graffiti art, and emceeing or rapping, and heard how Latinos were part of developing each. Today, part two. Looking at how the role of Latinos in hip-hop became blurred as rap music became commercially successful. How one element turned into a commodity and changed everything. Now, there are lots of subcultures of hip-hop we could have talked about. Pockets of Latinos around the United States and beyond who contributed to hip-hop culture. But we're going to explore how Latinos have fared within more mainstream rap. What happens when something small becomes big business? And shifts with the times.
I graduated from high school in 1984. And then the next 4 years, I was in Middletown, Connecticut at Wesleyan. Graduated from there in 88.
Before he co-hosted the underground radio show that broke some of the biggest names in hip-hop, Bobby, or Babito Garcia, was a New York kid who left the city for 6 years to go to school.
But so much changed in that six-year period. I mean, so much.
He says that in the 80s, hip-hop was diverse and inclusive. Latinos were an obvious part of it.
By the mid-80s and late 80s, a great thing happened, the emergence of MCs who were either Five Percenters or Muslims or Ansar Allah. So rap, that medium, became very identified with African-American culture, black culture, black power.
And that brought about some very smart, very political artists.
You know, you had Public Enemy. You had Lakim Shabazz, you know, who had a song called No Justice, No Peace. You had Rakim. They were all dropping knowledge that was coming from 5% studies and teachings.
And this changed things for some.
What that created was that there were a lot of Latinos outside of that that might have felt, well, is rap still for me? Or, I mean, most of us who were really down, we were like, yo, cool, speak your piece, like, more power to that. I felt, I still felt as much of a part of hip-hop, even though the face of hip-hop had really changed. But then the 90s came, and things just took a turn. When I first got on a radio show with Stretch on WKCR 89.9 FM, I might have had a little trepidation, like, do I have a right to do a hip-hop show as a Boricua voice? The simplicity of it was that at its root, hip-hop was inviting. At its root, hip-hop was inclusive. And so I clung to that.
We'll hear more from Bobbito and about the radio show he and Stretch Armstrong created later in the show. But around 1989, 1990, if you were hearing rap on pop radio, it probably sounded like this. Funky Cole Medina. And whether you spoke Spanish or not, as a Latino, it was hard not to notice this song, Mentirosa. So we begin in California with this guy.
Yo soy un piano Sergio Reyes, a.k.a. Mellow Man Ace.
Check this out, baby.
A.k.a. El Padrino, a.k.a. the Babyface Assassin. If you remember correctly,
as we learned in part one,
in the 70s, in the late 70s, early 80s, rappers were really, you know, about, let me see if I can get laid with this.
That's not how we put it, but yes.
By the time it had escalated to the mid 80s, to the late 80s, not only did you have to bubble your name out on the street battling guys, you also weren't complete unless you had a record deal now. So it had evolved.
So how does a little kid born in Cuba and raised in Los Angeles County, become a rapper with a hit record?
I'll start on my block. I grew up on a street called Cypress Hill Avenue, right? Cypress Avenue. And we turned it into a, you know, a big business.
Oh, right. He also had a little something to do with a well-known hip-hop group of the same name.
I will just say I'm the fourth founding member of Cypress Hill.
Ace's brother is Sendog.
My brother and I are the only two members who actually lived on Cypress Hill.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So Ace is an immigrant kid in Southgate, California.
And for us, we were trying to be B-boys really from New York City. We were trying to mimic everything that came out of the city. We had the bomber jackets with the fur on the top. We had the Lee jeans, you know, the Adidas with the fat laces.
They were drawn to the East Coast hip-hop scene for a few reasons. One being that even though they were Latino, they didn't quite fit in where they were.
We were surrounded by a predominantly Mexican demographic. In the early 70s, when I first came, we'd have to fight everybody. You know, the Mexicans didn't understand why we were black and spoke fluent Spanish, and the black people didn't like the fact we were light-skinned and didn't speak English.
Caribbean Latinos weren't common in his area.
A lot of people didn't know what a Cuban was or what a Puerto Rican was or a Dominican. I remember getting on the bus in the 70s, and some other people would be talking about me in Spanish, and I would, before my stop, I'd turn back around and fire some Spanish words at them, and they just light up like, oh, man, he understood we were calling them a straight.
Plus, his most direct inspiration came from New York City.
Mr. Schick of the Mean Machine had a rhyme that he said on that song Disco Dream, where he rapped in Spanish. It's the first time I'd ever heard Spanish rap. That, to me, showed me my future. So I knew by 1983 what I wanted to do, and it was to be like Mr. Schick. He's a very unsung hero of hip-hop. A lot of guys don't give him a lot of credit.
Even the Black Power movement within hip-hop was inspiring Ace and his friends.
You know, a lot of the early MCs that were Latino didn't go out of their way to necessarily say they were Latino. And I think once we got our hands on it, we wanted to make sure that we put our stamp on it too. You know what I mean? Like, if Public Enemy could say, I'm pro-black, I'm proud to be black, we felt like, you know, hey, we can say we're proud to be Latino.
So he took what he loved and added who he was to it.
I decided to use a more traditional Cuban look with the Panama hat, the guayabera shirt, the tobaccos coming out the shirt, but still spitting real hip-hop.
He also thought a lot about how to go about rapping in Spanish.
In the early days of those records that I heard that were in Spanish, a lot of guys were trying to be really tricky, which is why I think it didn't blow up at that time. And so when we set out to do this, you know, we wanted to make sure that we did it in a simple form so the people could get it. That if it was too complicated, they were going to miss it.
Which led him to Spanglish.
Changing each sentence as we go. English, Spanish, English, Spanish, Spanish, English, Spanish, English. And just switching the languages by creating the last rhyming word on the second bar of every rhyme.
Now I really want to ask you, guess if it
would I lie?
And please, por favor, tell me la verdad.
Ace found his way to a record deal when he tagged along with DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill to a recording session.
And it happened to be at Delicious Vinyl Studio. They said, hey, man, you know, we just signed a guy by the name of Tone Loc, man. And we've signed another dude by the name of Young MC, man. We're looking for MCs, dude. And I was like, I MC? And they were like, yeah, let's hear something, you know? I said, I even rap in Spanish. They said, what?
He was offered a contract with Delicious Vinyl the following week. And pretty soon, he had a hit with Mentirosa.
Today you tell me something, y mañana otra cosa.
It went to number 14 on the Billboard Hot 100. It stayed on the charts for 24 weeks. We've got more with Meloman Ace right after the break. Stay with us.
Before we get back to our show, I want to read you a note that we got from a recent new donor. Oh my God, and she's our former intern. Her name is Genesis. What? Genesis, you're amazing. She writes to us, thanks for all the work you do, exclamation point, and thank you for the great playlists, smiley face. Thank you, mi querida Genesis. We miss you a lot. And if you can, I hope you'll join Genesis and other listeners just like her. Go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. Maybe you'll consider supporting us with a monthly gift. Every penny helps our independent media. And one more favor, if you can go to iTunes to rate and review Latino USA, this really helps new listeners to find us. And we love your comments. Thanks a lot.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Yo, what up? This is Mellow Man Ace, and you're tuned in to Latino USA and Latino History and Hip Hop, Part 2. Peace.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario in for Maria Hinojosa. Rapping in Spanglish meant that Ace could do promotion in English and in Spanish.
So I would be one day on the Cristina show. The next day, I could be doing a Bob Hope special, or I could do Arsenio Hall and then do the Maria Laria show or Sábado Gigante the next day.
It was crazy, but it was great.
What I didn't like was where it would take me next. Hip-hop was growing and evolving, and now you had groups like Das FX coming in with these bizarre styles like bump skiddly, doing these things, and people like Drez of Black Sheep, The Choice Is Yours.
By now, Ace's record contract had been bought out by Capitol Records.
My record company, they were like, you found your niche, so just keep making bilingual records. And I'm like, my grandfather's a musician who invented 16 danzón rhythms in Pinar del Río, Cuba. If he found out I was making the same record four times, he'd turn over in his grave. I can't do it. Why doesn't these people just keep believing that what I'm telling them is why they signed me in the first place is this is cool, this is what's happening, just like you believed in Spanish and bilingual rap before, keep believing in what I'm telling you, and we're going to win with this formula. And their approach was, well, Coca-Cola wouldn't dare change the color of their can now. And that's what they would say. But Coca-Cola doesn't have to evolve. You love it because it's crack, liquid crack. But music and musicians grow and they experiment. So now I had a great run from 1988 to about 93 when that next record was going to come out. So it was a good five fun years. And then after that, the music stopped. I'm like, I'm taking a vacation. I don't care. Like, I'm gone. And it took about 5 or 6 years to really figure out for me what to do next. Because between then, I was just spending all the money that I had earned on tour and through my royalties, and I was just partying everywhere.
He was still really young at this point, and he had a lot to figure out. Eventually, Mellow Man Ace came back around to music.
The next thing was to sign myself to my own companies, do things from a platform which I can control. Because, see, when you're up at that level, you don't belong to yourself anymore. You belong to an itinerary and a deadline.
He says the reach isn't the same, and, of course, the money isn't. But that's okay.
I have the freedom now to just make the music I want to do because I'm doing me. I'm doing what's important to me to leave behind on my legacy. And if I die tomorrow, all you have to do is go back and see this guy went, well, he was going out for hip hop the whole time.
And he is still out there making music, spreading knowledge. He's really big on positivity.
You know, I'm very about the upliftment, you know, knowledge, wisdom, understanding.
As Ace was making less noise, a very different sound was brewing around him in California.
But they're a little bit different. They're more about the darkness, the skulls, the things of that nature, the underworld.
He's talking, of course, about his brother's group, Cypress Hill, the group he left to start a solo career. Here's hip-hop blogger Dallas Penn.
How incredible was Cypress Hill during the era of nihilism in hip-hop? When everyone was walking around with black hoodies on, because, I mean, the music was just, it was dark. It was fun, but it was dark.
Meanwhile, in New York City, Babito Garcia, who we met earlier, had Cypress Hill on his radio show before they were stars.
When they first came out, there was a lot of confusion. I remember B-Real coming up to me and Stretch's radio show on WKCR. And, you know, callers were like, yo, who them cats Cypress Hill? They not from the Bronx. Like, yo, they whack and whatever, whatever.
But by 2 months later, listeners had warmed up to their single, How I Could Just Kill a Man.
And I remember people calling up and being like, yo, I thought they was right before, but damn, I can't find you. Can you play that record?
Cypress Hill wasn't the only group Babito met before they blew up. Beginning in 1990, he co-hosted one of the most important radio programs in the history of hip-hop, the Stretch Armstrong and Babito Show.
And Stretch! And Stretch!
Babito!
And Stretch!
And Stretch!
There were all these younger artists, regardless of whether they were signed or unsigned. They were man, woman, young, old, So long as they had skills, they had a home at our show to showcase their talent.
So stick with us. We got some joints. And we got Fat Joe on his way up here.
Stretch and Bobbito were two New York City kids, one white, one Puerto Rican, both obsessed with hip-hop. They met while Bobbito was working a low-level job at Def Jam Records. And the radio show they started became the launchpad for an entire generation of hip-hop mega talent. Nearly every important artist from the era, you name them, was featured on the show before they were signed.
Nas, Biggie, Wu-Tang, Big Pun, Mobb Deep, Eminem, Cameron. It's just insane. So I'm up here for Delphi. But actually, I'm not up here for Delphi. I got some peoples in the house, Spin, and my man Chris from Metro DJ News. And we got Lars Professor and Akinelli up here.
The show aired on the Columbia University station, WKCR, super late on Thursday nights. But if you were a hip-hop fan in New York, it didn't matter if it was a school night. You were listening.
Stretch and I were averaging maybe 100,000 to 150,000 listeners a week on a college station that had a really poor signal at the worst possible time slot from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. You think about that.
This was, of course, before the internet really took off. So if you missed the show, you couldn't find it online the next day. But there were other ways.
Lars brought up his sampler. So guess what? I think peoples need to get home right now and get your tapes ready. If you don't have a tape, go to local bodega. They only about two balls. And get your tape decks ready, because we got some for you tonight. That's word to my mother.
People right, taped so shows physically. And then from there, the tape got dubbed, shared, bootlegged.
Commercial radio wasn't yet focused on hip-hop, so Stretch and Bobbito's show was one of the main ways to tap into what was still a relatively underground culture at the time.
And the thing about hip-hop from its inception, it was always about the effort that it took to discover. It allowed people who did make that effort to feel a sort of like a badge of honor.
But by the mid-90s, word had gotten out.
Knit hats and really big pants have been seen on beat boys in cities all along, but now they're turning up on mall-hopping suburban youth. There's a cross-culturalization happening, and it's happening through hip-hop style.
Hip-hop had truly exploded commercially. By 95, two of the top pop radio stations in the country, Hot 97 in New York and Power 106 in Los Angeles, had switched their formats to focus on hip-hop and R&B. Some Latinos made it on air as rappers.
Yeah, I remember Fat Joe coming up to our show. When he came to the studio, he just felt so familiar to me. He reminded me of my cousin, Joselito. He really did.
Fat Joe, a Bronx MC, founded the all-Latino Terror Squad rap dynasty.
Fat Joe, his first live radio appearance was on Mia Stretch's radio show. 12 years later, Fat Joe had the most played rap record in radio history. Ow! With Lean Back.
Yeah!
I mean, it's since been eclipsed, but you know, at that time, he had the record. And I'm proud of him.
Yeah. I don't give a fuck about your faults or mishaps. We from the Bronx, New York, things happen. Kids clapping, love to spark the place. Half the cats in the squad got a scar on their face.
Latino artists Nori and the Beatnuts also had songs that charted. But Latino voices were even more prominent as DJs on these commercial stations, especially at Hot 97 in New York.
Hot 97.
Where Angie Martinez held down the afternoon drive.
Welcome, guys, to the Angie Martinez Show. I am Angie Martinez, and this is my show.
For years, the station was the highest rated of any genre in New York City. Angie even parlayed that success into her own rap career, appearing on this song with Lil' Kim in 1997.
It's ladies' night, what? It must be Angie on the mic. The butterpea, honey, got the sugar, got the spice. Wrote
it went platinum and was nominated for 2 Grammys.
I'm the rookie on this all-star team. Me and Kim is getting cream.
Hot 97 also gave hip-hop DJ Camilo, DJ Enough, and of course, Cypher Sounds.
Cypher Sounds, Big Dog Pitbull, Hot 97.
We weren't like trained broadcasters. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're all hip-hop fans. When Hot 97 came about, it was the first station to play hip-hop all day long as a format. So we naturally progressed to be radio personalities, but no one ever questioned it because we were Latino. Like, our voices were just hip-hop. Yo, ladies and gentlemen, DJ Enough is here.
Yeah.
Yours truly, Cypher Sounds, and our good friend, his name is Bodega Bams.
Yeah.
What's up, what's up?
Bodega Bams is one of my favorite up-and-coming artists. I hate saying the term up-and-coming, sorry.
Me too.
One of my favorite artists, not just because you're Puerto Rican. Oh, damn, you made a Spanish joke already?
But for Cypher and Babito, who they were in terms of ethnicity was an afterthought. They were in it for the culture they loved, period.
We didn't celebrate our Latino heritage on the air because in the form of hip-hop, a lot of that becomes secondary, even tertiary. The most important thing is who's nice on the mic. So you're not looking at their background, their heritage, their nationality. It's just like, yo, like, this dude's incredible. Or this woman's incredible. Like, now it's hip-hop. Let's try to all be in this together.
Meanwhile, as Cypress Hill became superstars out of California and Babito and other DJs held it down in New York,
one man became the voice of Miami.
Oh, hey, Marlon. This is Marlon Bishop. He's a producer here at Latino USA, and we've been working together on these episodes about hip-hop.
And just having the most amazing radio time.
Man, I adore doing these interviews. And Marlon is here to introduce us to...
$1,000 Thursday coming tomorrow. We're in the mix now. DJ Laz on Power 96!
This is Lazaro Mendez, a.k.a. DJ Laz, and he's a key figure in Miami's very distinct hip-hop history.
Miami had it was a party vibe, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't so much talking about dope dealing and this, and I'm going to go, and we were about, oh, you want to go shoot somebody up? You go have fun. I'm going to go over here and party with these beautiful ladies. You go do your thing over there, and I'll be over here. I bet you my party's going to be a lot more fun than yours.
The party sound that Laz is talking about is called Miami bass.
Or Miami booty music.
Yes, and the Miami bass sound is rooted in electro music from New York. It sort of prefigured hip-hop, specifically Planet Rock by Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, which, if I remember correctly, is your mom's favorite song. Right, Daisy?
That's right. If you heard part one, you know it's true.
You took the speed of that, but then one thing that Miami added was that 808 quad bass that would rattle a trunk. And that's how Miami got its, that's how it became Miami booty music, Miami bass music, because it had a lot of knock to it, a lot more knock than anywhere else. You know, Planet Rock had a great beat, but it didn't have a hum. You know what I'm saying? Miami booty records had a hum to them, where... It was, you felt it. If you were in a club or in a car that had bass, you felt that bass.
Starting in the late 80s, bass ruled Miami. But by the 90s, the sound was big all over the country. I'm sure you remember this song.
Yes, Woot, There It Is. Not to be confused with Woot, There It Is, which I actually preferred.
I can't believe there were two songs with the same name at the same time. Fun fact. Both were classic Miami bass songs. And since Miami is such a Latino city, it should come as no surprise that a number of the people responsible for creating and nurturing the sound were Latino, especially DJ Laz. Like many people in Miami, Laz's parents were exiles from Cuba.
Cuban household all day. That if you didn't speak Spanish, you didn't eat.
And Laz was born with a muscular disorder that left his legs badly deformed. He had 17 surgeries as a kid and spent much of his childhood bound to a wheelchair.
I had a lot of time at home. Surgeries, casts, pins through my knees. And I remember telling my old man one day, I said, hey, do me a favor. You never have to buy me anything ever again. Get me a pair of turntables, a mixer, some speakers. So while everybody else is outside being kids, at least I have something to do inside.
Hold up, wait a minute, let us put some boom in.
And I remember the day that it clicked into my head that this is what I want to do. I remember vividly. I went to a party with my brother.
Laz's brother happened to be a DJ.
I saw my brother play music, make people happy, meet women, and get paid at the end of the night. I said, this, my friends, this is for me, right here. That was the day that I said, this is what I want to do with my life. After I started, doing the parties with my brother, I said, man, I want to be on the radio. And lo and behold, boom.
Which led him to Power 96, where they asked him to host the station's morning show and beyond.
And then I said, man, I want to make my own records. I don't just want to play people's records on the air. I want to make my own.
So tell me the first time you did that.
I was sitting at home in my Florida room.
Apparently a Florida room is a kind of room a lot of people have in Florida. Who knew?
Floridians.
And on the left turntable, I had an instrumental from Clay D, Beatmaster Clay D, which was called Boot the Booty. And on the right turntable, I had Wilfredo Vargas, El Africano, which is Mami, el negro está rabioso. And I played the booty beat, and I started scratching the Mami, el negro. And then I mixed it. And it was perfect. And I said, wow, this sounds good. And I was excited. I was like, wow, I can't wait for people to hear this.
Stop the drums, it's time to attack and hit the people with a brand new track. Come on, come on, cause the party's packed. The DJ's cut like a lumberjack.
The track was titled Mami El Negro. Laz started playing it on his radio show, and people loved it.
They were like, yo, what's that? That sounds dope, blah, blah, blah. People that couldn't speak Spanish loved it. They had no idea what it was saying, but the melody was good and the beat was good, and it just made you want to party.
Knowing a winning formula when he saw one, Laz continued to rack up hits by mashing up merengue and Miami bass. He put out his first album in 91.
You know, the rest is history.
Laz held it down as a DJ at Power 96 for 22 years in total. And he put out 8 studio albums. And he's still going strong today.
Miami bass music, not so much.
No, Miami bass peaked in the 90s.
But it had a lasting impact on mainstream hip-hop.
Right. The southern rap sound known as crunk that came out in the late 90s, that comes out of Miami bass.
And southern rap dominated commercial hip-hop for years.
Oh, and I can think of one other way that DJ Laz's legacy is living on.
Oh, let's see. Up-tempo club hip-hop from Miami with a Spanglish sensibility. Who could it be?
Mr. Worldwide Pitbull. I'm Uncle Laz, basically. You know, I call him my nephew.
DJ Laz is Pitbull's adopted uncle.
He has taken a sound, because if you listen to some of his music, like Hotel Room Service, that's a booty record. That is a booty record that he took global. He's a superstar, without a doubt.
We could safely say there would be no Pitbull without Miami bass. And I think we could both agree, Daisy, that would be a terrible world to live in.
That would be the worst. Thanks, Marlon.
Mr. Worldwide to infinity, you know the roof on fire. We go boogie, oogie, oogie, jiggle, wiggle, and dance like the roof on fire. We go drink drinks and take shots until we fall out like the roof on fire. Now, baby, get my booty naked, take off all your clothes and light the roof on fire. Tell him, baby, 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 I'm on fire. I tell her, baby, 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 I'm a fireball.
Coming up on Latino USA, the one, the only, Big Pun. Stay with us.
Fireball. I saw I came, I conquered. Or should I say I saw I conquered, I came. This little chico on fire.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here from the TED Radio Hour, and I'm really excited to tell you about another podcast I'm hosting. It's called How I Built This, and it's a show about the most amazing innovators and entrepreneurs and the stories behind the companies and movements they built. The show launches on September 12th. You can find it at npr.org/podcasts, on iTunes, or on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Gilchrist Foundation, supporting NPR's enduring commitment to making music, arts, and culture accessible to audiences in the Midwest and across America. More information is available at thegilchristfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Daisy Rosario, in for Maria Hinojosa. Look, we can't talk about Latinos in hip-hop without talking about Big Pun, the first Latino solo rapper to ever go platinum.
But you thought Pun shit was sweet, now you can't sleep. Gotta keep your eyes open wide and hide your face from the streets. I'm like the beast with a warrant, far from a norm. Gave you fair warning, now you wanna stand squalling. I'm calling out any rapper that...
But we can't talk to Big Pun. He died in 2000. So we went to people who knew him.
I'm Liza Rios, the wife of the late, great Big Pun.
We met at a White Castle in the Bronx. Her idea. She said Pun liked to stop there after shows.
Yeah, it'd be quite hilarious. It's like close to the house, coming off the highway. You know, it's the only thing that's open. So let's just roll through with this, back in the 90s, a big old stretch limo, you know, trying to squeeze into the drive-thru. After a couple of times, like, people already knew, like, oh, yeah, this is Pun picking up White Castles.
I can't imagine that drive-thru was made for limos either.
No, it wasn't. You know, the guy had to be really swift with the turn.
Liza first met Pun when he was just a kid, named Christopher Rios.
Junior high school sweethearts, we met at, I was 14, he was 15. He was just really annoying. And then one day he just convinced my girlfriend to convince me to go out with him. We just clicked. And then it was, he made me laugh. That's what it was, you know, like... I remember the first time he made me laugh. He was in the lunchroom. It's a whole bunch of kids, and he stood on top of the table, and he did the whole Urkel impression. From there, it was just like, no matter how much of a bad time we had, he could always make me laugh.
Everyone we spoke to said that Pun was so funny, a real prankster.
You couldn't eat. You eat around him, don't leave your food around him, because you turn, whatever, it will either be too salty or he'll put, you know, sugar in it.
So he was mad funny, like there's always pranks.
Though sometimes the pranks were a bit dark, like this one he pulled on Cypher Sounds.
So this is a story I always tell, but like we were in this club called the Flamingo Club, and Pun was there, and he orders. He's like, yo, let me get two Hennessys. The bartender gives us two Hennessys, and he goes, Cypher, I bought you a shot of Hennessy. And I was like, oh, thanks, Pun, but I don't drink. I don't drink at all. I drank three times in my life. He's like, oh, you don't drink? Pulls out a gun from his waist, cocks it, puts it in my stomach, and verbatim goes, Cypher, I bought you a shot of Hennessy. So I was like, okay. So I take the shot. Then he turns to the bartender and says, two more. I run down the stairs. I just ran and hid.
New York City soundtrack right now.
Right now we're in like in the South Bronx on 163rd and Rogers Place.
This is BG183. He's a member of Tats Crew, a legendary group of graffiti artists from the Bronx.
And this location is like, again, you know, it's dominated by, you know, Latinos.
We're standing in front of a mural that the Tats Crew painted for Pun.
And this picture is basically a picture of him way before he gained weight. So this is like the beginning of Pun.
The detail is really, really gorgeous. The perspective is amazing. Like, the work on this is beautiful. The Pun Wall is one of the classic Bronx murals. Nobody messes with it, and tourists come to see it. Both are signs of how important Pun is to the borough. Big Pun grew up near here, and he stayed in the neighborhood even after he became successful, all the way until his death. On the right-hand side of the mural, it reads, Bronx legend Christopher Rios, hip-hop's first Latin platinum artist. And, of course, there's a Puerto Rican flag.
In a way, you know, Pun is our version of, you know, the all-American sports hero.
This is Nicer, also of Tats Crew. He worked on the mural as well.
He was that kid from the ghetto that, you know, made something of himself. And it's that success story that, you know, it's something that should be praised and should be, you know, shown to the kids.
When it comes to Latinos in hip-hop, nobody looms quite as large as Big Pun. Cypher Sounds first met Pun when Pun appeared on the Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito show back in 95, before anyone knew who he was.
Hey, yo, Stretch! Yo, Stretch! Yo, Stretch!
What's up?
Yo, this is the fattest beat. Fattest beat.
So I was up there one night with my boy DJ Riz. He's like my mentor. He was guest DJing. Fat Joe came in with three of his new artists.
So, but Big Dog Punisher was Big Pun's name before it was Big Pun. And he was sitting, like, he was so fat, he always had to sit on the edge of the chair. And he just started rhyming.
Brothers are rapping like Iraqin soldiers, acting like they cracking boulders with impact a captain.
And the whole room went quiet. Like, we're like, who is this guy?
Hey, yo, my murderous rap, verbal attack is actual fact. Tactical tracks match perfectly with graphical stats. Half of you lack the magical dap of tragical rap that tackles you back in shackles of that.
They were quiet because they couldn't believe Pun's flow. He had a killer vocabulary, tricky wordplay. He was especially known for these crazy tongue-twisting rhymes.
Dead in the middle of little, little did we know that every riddle's a middleman who didn't do diddly.
In 1998, Pun released his debut album, Capital Punishment. It went double platinum, selling over 2 million albums. You probably recognize the hit song, Still Not a Player.
I'm not a player, I just crush a lot.
But before making it as a rapper, his wife Liza said she and Pun struggled a lot. They married when they were still teenagers, and by the time she was 21, they already had 3 children. For a time, they lived in a homeless shelter. Liza says she stood by his side through it all.
He wanted to make a mark in this world. He wanted to leave something behind, and he found freedom in the music. You know what I'm saying? It was an outlet for him. So that's like his first love, so I honor that.
His passion eventually paid off. But he couldn't escape a dark side that extended well beyond his jokes. People who cared about him, like Cypha, worried about his spending habits.
What he did with his money was ridiculous. Like, he had an apartment in the Bronx with a shark tank in it. He would have, like, 5 or 6 cars outside parked on the sidewalk. But he would just pile up tickets. I just felt bad. Like, I was like, this money's not gonna last.
Pun had a rough life. No father, a mother addicted to drugs. And in the years since his death, Liza has spoken openly about the physical abuse she faced in their marriage.
Our relationship was really bad in some sense, so that took a toll. And I was like, most of the time, I was just like in survival mode. So you just do what you had to do, and you're like on autopilot.
His demons manifested in other ways as well. In the pathological eating that caused him to balloon to almost 700 pounds. His weight was unsustainable, and he knew it. A week before he died, Pun called up his sister, Pina, and made an unusual request.
He said, Pina, I want you to come down, stay at the hotel with us, with the kids.
Pina said she couldn't do it. She had tickets to see freestyle singer George LaMond in concert.
And my brother said, are you serious? He goes, what if I die next week? I swear, this is a true story. And I flew up, and we had the most amazing weekend. The kids were in the pool, and he was actually supposed to perform in Saturday Night Live that weekend. He told me, stay upstairs with me for a second while the kids go to the pool. I said, okay, and we're sitting at the edge of the bed, and he goes, you know what? I don't think I'm going to go to Saturday Night Live. And I go, what are you talking about? This is huge, Christopher. And he goes, you see that armoire, Pina? And I go, yeah. He goes, can you put that on your back and walk down the hall? He goes, I walk with that armoire on my back every day. He said, my legs can't hold my body anymore. And I said, Christopher, you know, and he put his hand on my thigh. He goes, I just want you to know that I love you and I'm glad that you came. And the next morning, I had a 6 a.m. flight with my kids and we left. And Liza called me that afternoon, my brother passed away. And I get chills right now telling you this story. But if I would have went to that George LaMond concert, I would have lost those last moments with my brother. So, I miss him. I miss him more than words can express.
Big Pun died of a heart attack on February 7th, 2000. He was 28 years old. Graffiti artist Bio and the rest of Tat's crew were scheduled to go out and paint promotional murals for Pun's upcoming second album that same day.
And we kept getting calls to the office from people saying, hey, is it true that Pun passed away? And we're like, so I was like, let me call Joe.
Bio said they didn't even have to think about it. They knew they had to go out and paint something for Pun.
And we didn't tell anyone that we were going out there. We just sort of went out there, grabbed our paint, went over there, started painting. Maybe about an hour in, 50 people showed up. 2 hours in, that's like almost 100 people. 3 hours in, it's a madhouse. Like, there's news vans. There's people from all over the city. There's cars. They close the street. It's insanity.
Pun's funeral lasted 3 days. Thousands of fans turned up to pay their respects. Almost every year, around Pun's death anniversary, Tat's crew repaints the memorial wall, and fans come out to leave candles there. Big Pun might seem like an unlikely hero for the Bronx, but hip-hop, from the start, has always been about making something out of nothing. And through sheer skills on the mic, an overweight Puerto Rican kid from the hood became an international cultural icon. And for some Latinos, who grew up in hip-hop but were sometimes told they didn't belong, he was a champion, and they loved him for it.
Big Pun to the Bronx was like a symbol of, you know, of success. Someone who started from nothing, came out of here, and, you know, he was a humble, accessible person. So he gave, a lot of the younger Latinos that hope, like, here's someone who's just like us who made it. If he can make it, I can do it.
You know, growing up, it was almost like a written law. If you're Puerto Rican, you have to be a Big Pun fan.
Bodega Bams is one of the biggest Latino rap artists to break through in recent years, with local radio and club hits like this one, Don Francisco.
Yeah, my skin tan, my fade low, my eyes green for those pesos. Each, I don't seem huesos. I'm pit bull when I'm fago.
And he says that Big Pun's success showed him that being a famous rapper was possible for a Latino. But
I hate the fact that people say he's the best Latino rapper. Say he's one of the best rappers. I'm saying don't put that box on him. He's the best Latino rapper. I hate that.
And as much as Bodega Bams is inspired by Pun, he says it's lazy to compare them.
I'm not here to take Pun's torch. You know what I'm saying? I'm not here even walking his shoes. And I always say this, like, I don't want to walk in Pun's shoes. I'd rather just put Pun's shoes over my shoulders and walk in my own.
The lyricism of it, you know, he totally embodied hip-hop attitude.
Bodega Bams is, of course, not the only recent Latino artist influenced by Pun. Nitty Scott MC opened up her 2011 mixtape, The Cassette Chronicles, with a cover of Pun's iconic song, Twins.
Dead in the middle, a little Italy, kick a little riddle, de-diddle, committal to spit it and wittily.
That was actually, you know, a homage, you know, even though the record Twins was actually Pun's cover of Deep Cover.
The Dr. Dre song.
So I thought it was dope because I can sort of pay homage to both of them, which is alluding to my Afro-Latina.
Nitty Scott grew up the child of an African-American father and a Puerto Rican mother in Orlando, Florida. At just 17, she moved to New York to make it as a rapper. She's since gained recognition as one of the freshest voices in underground hip-hop. When I spoke to Nitty, we talked about how she, like many Latino MCs, wrestles with her identity. You know, one of the things that we've been talking, when we're talking to so many people about Pun, is he didn't want to be the best for a Latino, but
right.
He was very, very proud of being a Latino. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that as you're continuing to build in your career?
Well, it's interesting because in my early career, when I first came out, I was actually advised by my previous management to sort of keep my Latino quiet, to just, you know, not necessarily to deny it or anything like that, but to not represent it too much because it was going to put me in a certain category or in a certain box.
All of this is like, you know, is this a black thing or, you know, are Latinos really a part of this? Like, all of that is even complicated by the fact that we don't really acknowledge Afro-Latinos that much in general.
Yes, absolutely not. And, you know, I was told that if I wanted to be given an opportunity to become a staple, that I had to identify with black people. And I mean, I agree to a certain extent, but not to the point that the other part of me should be tucked away.
Questions of who belongs where are always tricky. The answers, usually quite complicated. But for so many Latinos today, hip-hop is the cultural language we speak.
My exposure to, like, America was hip-hop.
Take the story of the Kid Mero, for example. He's a comedian and writer. You might know him from MTV's Guy Code. Mero grew up in a Dominican immigrant household in New York. But the world outside his apartment? That was a hip-hop world.
LL Cool J, man. Like, I remember hearing LL Cool J and being like, wow, like, this is, like, and not understanding what rap music was, but just being like, yo, this is dope. Like, this doesn't sound like anything my parents play at home, but I like this.
And that world he discovered, he says, shapes everything he does.
Growing up in that, that kind of just comes through in everything I do, like, comedy-wise, writing, whatever, like, it's through that lens of, like, a dude from the Bronx who was heavily influenced by hip-hop and also, like, my Latino background.
As we've tried to show with this Latino History of Hip-Hop series, there are historical reasons for the deep identification some Latinos feel with hip-hop culture. Just listen to Bodega Bams talk about it.
I'm happy to be a part of the hip-hop culture. You know what I'm saying? That the African Bambaataz and the Kool Herc who created it. With their idea, they planted a seed and it kept on growing and growing and growing and made more trees and it made more leaves fell. And I'm just happy to be a part of that whole family tree, man.
And as time goes on, Nitty Scott hopes more and more people will recognize that Latinos are and always have been a vital part of that tree.
You know, hip-hop was born in the Bronx, you know? What do you think of when you think of the Bronx? You know, it's Latinos, you know? And the more of us that, you know, are out here reminding people of our presence, you know, I think it will be something that is sort of generally understood at some point in the future. I do.
I said he drew. You don't know if I got a gun. It's fun from the X side of things. Forget inside my rings. Everything I want, I get. Bada bing, it's mine. I shine like money that sound like Biggie. All around my town, boogie down my city. Come around, get down.
Were you trying to get crazy with this, eh? Don't you know I'm loco?
Producer Daisy Rosario. Thanks, Daisy. And that's it for this week. This episode of Latino USA was originally produced by Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Our office coordinator is Mariko Gwynn. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. And if you enjoyed the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And we'll see you again next week. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I'm killing this interview.
You are?
Just give me the whole hour.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. And the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we take a deep dive into the glamorous, fun, and controversial world of quinceañeras.
We're having a great time so far. That was so weak. Have you guys had dinner or no?
That's next time on Latino USA.